morning. I hope y'all can hear me. Can y'all hear me? Okay. Good morning, Roosevelt McNeil, alcoholic. First, I would like to thank Nick for asking me to share this morning. And Lynette had said it, you know, for, you know, ghetto birds, man, like us, man. You know, wasn't nobody asking us to do nothing. Wasn't nobody asking us to come around. You know, the drunks that we were, man, and the havoc that we gave, you know, there wasn't nobody asking us to come around. But I would like to thank Nick for asking me to come. And I would like to thank the 85th anniversary of Founders Day for allowing me to come. You know, congratulations to 85 years of recovery, of helping each one teach one. Man, I tell you, you know, it's talking about Bill and Bob, and man, we're talking about in the 30s, man. You know, to touch a brother like me in 2001, that's huge. That's huge, not just me, but many, many, many others. You know, I'm just grateful, man. I'm grateful. Like I said, my name is Roosevelt McNeil. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January the 19th of 2001. There's so many I would like to thank. I would like to thank the people that spoke before me. I would like to thank all the panelists. You know, you did a great job. You know, this is my time of year. I like going to Founders Day because that's when I really get full. You know, I come and I catch all the meetings, man, and, you know, that's my, you know, connection to the generator. You know, I get plugged back in, and I'm ready to go again after that weekend, you know, so I'm fired up, man, that, you know, whether we doing the pandemic or whatever got going on, you know, I thank God for God being God all by himself. I would like to first thank Dale Starkey. You know, I know he's up in heaven and he's looking down. And he was one of the first ones that grabbed a hold to me. You know, Kevin Butts took me up there to Ignatia Hall. And I started going up there every day. And I met Dale up there. And Dale became my sponsor. And after Dale had went through an illness, then I got Manny DeFrangie. I want to thank Manny for being in my life, you know, and giving me a spiritual vision of this thing. You know, because Dale gave me the foundation. First, it was old Kevin Butts, you know, he was shoving that hardcore stuff on me. You know? And then there was Dale. Y'all have to excuse me. I am truly nervous. Then there was Dale, and he guided me, and he gave me the simplicity of the program. Manny gave me the spiritualness of the program, and Charlie Mall, my sponsor today, gives me the mirror man of the program. I'm 63 years old, and I was born and raised in Akron, Ohio, by my mother and my grandmother. You know, I was thinking of early about how scared of a child I was. You know, how I felt so displaced, how I felt, you know, so isolated within myself. You know, I was thinking about how I felt so lonely. You know, it was me and my sister, you know, I grew up in Akron, on the west side of Akron, you know, and my ghetto wasn't no harder than nobody else's, but we had rats and roaches and army surplus, powdered eggs and powdered milk and Spam in the can. And I didn't know nothing about this being bad or nothing being wrong about it, you know, until I walked out there and met the society of people. And people can turn things that are still good into bad. And you can grab a hold of these things, and I could turn things into bad that is good. anyway, you know, my mama drank, my grandmama drank, the whole family drank. You know, I thought it was going to be, that was part of what was going on, you know. And, you know, I didn't have a father, and y'all, everything that I am and everything that I've learned since I've been here in the program Alcoholics Anonymous. And it has taught me about, you know, having resentments and abandonment issues and all these things that I knew nothing about. You know, Lynette had spoke on it again about the language of the heart. You know, what comes from the heart reaches the heart. You know, and these things, man, you know, these are the things that was necessary when I come in the program. Well, I done went on back out, man, and I wouldn't have nothing to do with y'all people. You know, but it was that language of the heart, man, I believe it really continues to sustain me and sustain me early on. Anyway, you know, growing up, kids can be cruel to you, and they was cruel to me and my sister. They talked about it because there was a lot of violence going on. It was the police were at our house a lot of weekends, you know, and kids was quite cruel, you know, and I used to get beat up a lot because it was so much violence going on that I didn't want no violence. You know, I wanted some peace. I wanted some love, you know. I wanted to laugh and be happy, you know, and I used to get beat up a lot because I wouldn't raise my hand to fight. I would keep my hands down to the side. You know, I remember kids used to say, Roosevelt, fight them back, fight them back. I wouldn't even fight them back, and they'd beat me up all the way up the street. But my sister was my hero, see, and my sister wouldn't allow me to get beat up too much because she was my hero. I'd run home, you know, and she'd stand there and fight for me, you know, and that, you know, but she's still my hero. Anyway, y'all, I began to stay in the house and isolate early on. You know, I watched the drink, how they drank, what they drank, the way they drank, what they said when they drank, how they act when they drank. I watched a lot of TV. I watched the Humphrey Bogarts, the Randolph Scotts, the Artie Murphys, you know, the James Cagneys. I was watching on it, and I'm filling my head up with a lot of information, man. I don't know whether it was good or bad, but it was information at the time, you know, and I didn't know, you know, and I started acting out, you know, acting out in school. I started being able to imitate people and put on these different hats and wear these different faces. And boy, that's, man, that's exhausting to think about now. That's exhausting, man. Anyway, man, I put on all these different faces, and I can remember we had moved around the corner, man, to 656 Bellevue because we had stayed on Moon Street, and my mother asked me to do some imitating this particular day. Well, she asked me to imitate my my grandmother's boyfriend, you know, and I heard somebody talking about it during the course of the meetings that transpired this weekend, and it was talking about good influences and bad influences, you know. And looking back on him, man, and this particular gentleman that my mother asked me to imitate, he was a kind man, you know, and in trying to learn, you know, I'm steady trying to grow up. Somebody was talking about growing up, and then growing up, I got to look back on my bad influences and my good influences, and in the process, my mother asked me to imitate my grandmother's boyfriend, you know, and he was a kind man, and he was always trying to give me some good knowledge and trying to feed the positive energy into me. And this particular gentleman, man, they laughed and teased and talked about him too. You know, he had a big bump on the middle of his tongue, you know, and he talked funny, and his name was Samuel Ross, but they called him Booty Cootie. Anyway, you know, my mom asked me to imitate him, and she had a room full of people there. And, you know, when she asked me to imitate, there was a fifth of King's Reward wine and some Dixie cups on the table. So I kind of eased over there to that fifth of wine and them Dixie cups. And, you know, I know I'm wrong, but I'm trying to see how far I can get away, how far I can get away with this. You know, mama didn't say nothing, so I filled this here cup up with that wine, you know, and I'm still kind of waiting for mama to say something. And she didn't say nothing, and I don't hold it to her account. But I held this cup up, and I said what Sam would say, and I downed this drink. Now, when I down this drink, man, I'm feeling shameful because I know I'm out of bounds. I'm 9 years old and I ain't supposed to be doing this, but I'm feeling, you know, shameful, my head down. And when I lift my head up, it wasn't a warm, fuzzy feeling that got me. Hell, me and my sister got the warm, fuzzy feeling a long time ago because we was the cleanup crew. But what got me was when I lift my head up, everybody in the room laughed. I felt a sense of love. All the things that I thought were absent. I felt connection. I felt family. I felt all these things I thought were absent in my life. I felt them. Shoot. I grabbed that cup and I filled it up again. I held it up, man, and I said a few things and I downed this drink. But by now I'm starting to say stuff I ain't supposed to be saying. I'm acting the way I ain't supposed to be acting. Where I come from, they call it being mannish. And I can remember Mama say, all right, June, you getting a little mannish now. You going to bed. But I understand something about this particular story, that if Mama hadn't said nothing, I'd have probably either drank until that bottle was empty or I fell out. Did that make me an alcoholic, y'all? Heck, I don't know. All I know is I jumped on that conveyor belt to nowhere, and I began to ride it. I rode it to the detention home 26 times, 2 foster homes, 3 group homes, the Job Corps, BIS, and eventually the penitentiary. I can't say every last one of them times had something to do with a drink, y'all. But I can tell you, every last one of them times had something to do with the way I think. I didn't have a clue. I didn't know that I didn't know that I didn't know that I didn't know. See, what y'all told me it was undiagnosed alcoholism. See, because I can remember. My mama said, June, I need you to do this, this, and this. I said, okay, Mama, I'm going to do it. And I'd show back up 2-3 weeks, 2-3 months later, and Mama would say, June, I thought I asked you to do such, such. And she'd say, what happened? And the best I could tell her was, I don't know. I can remember being married because I kept me a little job. And I can remember being married and I'd come back home after being gone 3-4 months or 3-4 weeks, 3-4 days, whatever. And I'd come back home and I'd tell my wife, look here, we're going to pay this, this, and this. And me and you going, and the kids going to do this, this, and this. And we're going to take care of this and this. And I'd tell her that Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I'd confirm it on Thursday. And I'd leave out the house on Friday with that intent. But I would show back up on Sunday. And she'd say, honey, I thought we was going to do this and this, that, and this and the other. She'd say, what happened? And the best I could tell her was, I don't know. 1988, I found myself in one of them houses where ain't no electric, ain't no gas, ain't no running water. Pee so thick around the toilet look like butter. I'm down there in one of them basements, the candlelight burning. I'm looking across at somebody else talking about, I ain't that bad. And after being sitting down there for a couple of days, guy say, hey man, ain't you got a job? I said, yeah, I got a job. Somebody else say, hey, you know, you go to your job, man, tell them you got a problem and they can't fire you. Plus, they'll put you in one of them treatment centers. I said, well, I get all my information from an idiot. It sounded good to me. That's what I did. I went to the job. I told them I had a problem and they sent me out there to Edwin Shaw. I get out there to Edwin Shaw now. And you know, the book talks about it. The book says, unable to differentiate the true from the false. Now see, I had them block and anything to come against my drinking and my alcoholism, you know, I'd fight or flee or I'd hide and duck or I'd point the finger and say it was somebody else. There's some other reason other than me. I lie. I lie for nothing. The woman asked me a few simple questions at the assessment. She asked me, do you drink? How you drink? When you drink? How often you drink? I looked her straight in the face and I lied. I said, sometime, every now and then, one or two. And she looked at me and she just kind of shook her head. She knew I was lying. She sent me on upstairs. I get upstairs. It's a co-ed program, 28 days. We all sitting around in a circle, men talking about their problems. I'm saying I ain't that bad. And women talking about their problems, and I'm trying to figure out how I can fix them. And after 28 days, running my mouth, cotton in my ears, I left right back out of there and jumped on that conveyor belt to nowhere again. But the thing about it is it was no longer undiagnosed. I know what the problem was. The problem was Roosevelt McNeil. And Roosevelt McNeil don't know how to live. Roosevelt McNeil is not willing to take suggestions. Roosevelt McNeil is not willing to do what it takes to get this design for living that really works. January 19, 2001, I found myself homeless. My wife had done left me. My kids didn't want to have nothing to do with me. And my friends was like that boy DMX said, oh, it's him again, whenever I came around. You know, my mama had been bootlegging liquor for quite a long time. And I used to could go over there and get something to drink and go over there and serve the drinks for and collect the money. But now I can't go over there and collect the money because I was stealing and robbing from her. You know, I can't go over there and drink because mama said I was drinking up all the liquor. My mama had unconditional love for me and she'd let me sleep in that back room periodically. Not all the time, but periodically. Because she had unconditional love for her son. I come in my mama's house this day, full blown in my alcoholism, and I just wanted a drink, and I was willing to do whatever it took to get a drink. And she had what I liked in there. I reached over there and on the floor, and I grabbed my mama's half a gallon of Seagram's gin, and my mama begged me to put her liquor down. And I swole up on my mama and I told my mama, I'm drinking this. Very disrespectful. A lot of things that I ain't proud of, but it's the truth about Roosevelt. I went back there in that back room and I drank that half a gallon of Seagram's gin. And I sat back there on that bed and it didn't fill the void and it didn't stop the pain. See, I don't know about y'all, but for Roosevelt McNeil, I didn't come here to make friends. I came to stop that pain. I was hurting really bad. I'm sitting back there on that bed, man, and I done drank my mama's liquor, and I'm sitting back there, man, and I just started thinking about how I'd been disappointing the people that cared about me the most and tried to help me and tried to pour into me. I was thinking about how I disappointed them, how I disappointed myself. You know, I was thinking about how low I had become. I was thinking about how grimy I had become. I was thinking about all that skullduggery I had been doing out there in them streets. And I'm just beginning to cry, man. But I heard it, you know, everything I heard this good stuff in the room. And I heard somebody say it was that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization had done set in on me. And I was scared to death. I didn't know what to do. See, I could remember, you know, coming around to these rooms. See, I used to be in that revolving door at one time. In and out, in and out, in and out. I'm sitting there in that revolving door, in and out, in and out. I can remember, man, when I come here, y'all told me to get a sponsor. I remember the very first sponsor I had, his name was Toby Burton. And the only reason I got Toby Burton because he was my mama's friend. My mama when I was a kid. I asked Toby to be my sponsor. He said, sure. And we go into meetings and everything, man. I'm feeling a little good. 3-4 months go by, and one day I looked at Toby, and I found something wrong with him. Next thing you know, I was drunk. I can remember coming back. I come back, y'all told me get a sponsor. I see a guy, man, he look hip, slick, and cool. Look like the ladies after him, he bling, bling. And I said, well, shoot, that's my man right there. I went and asked him to be my sponsor. His name was Gary Lama. He trying to take me to meetings, man, trying to teach me, trying to show me the way and everything. About 3-4 months go by, I looked at him one day. I found something wrong with him. Next thing you know, I was drunk again. See, the reason why I have to remember these stories is because here's the deal. When I came in here this last time, man, I wanted to know, why can't I get it? Why ain't I keep coming in here, I keep seeing some of the same people, and they still here. Every time I come, they still here. Why can't I get it? You know, why can't I grab a hold of this thing? What's wrong with me? I told myself when I was sitting on that bed, man, and I wasn't sure. I was saying, man, I'm not going to try and look at the man. I'm going to try and see the God in the man. Because I know God ain't going to let nobody hurt. As scared as I was, I've been to church and I've been through all that. Ministers training, deacons training. I just all over the floor, crying and crawling around. I knew there was a power greater than me. I knew that it was something out there. You know, I always tried to get my pastors, you know, the way they seen God, the way my mama seen God, the way my wife seen God, where everybody else seen him. And every time I would, you know, I'd listen to them and I'd try and it just still wouldn't take. I couldn't hold to it. I don't know why, but I couldn't hold to it. Anyway, I'm sitting back there on that bed, man, and I don't believe it was that grown man, Roosevelt, 40-something years old, they cried out and asked God for help. I think it was that little kid, June, deep down inside. June that had seen it all, felt it all, that had been through it all, one that screamed and cried out, God, please help us. I think I was still full of false pride and the ego and everything else. And, you know, it wasn't going, you know, I got these voices in my head, too. You know, and so I didn't think that I could get it, but this kid screamed out. Anyway, right after that prayer of God, please help me, my very next thought was, one more. You know, it says cunning, baffling, and powerful. It was one more. I had an old Crabman toolbox set over the corner. Wasn't no more tools in, but my mom allowed me to keep the box. I went over there looking for some things, man, and I opened the drawer, man, and there was a piece of paper in there balled up, and I thought I'd gotten lucky. I grabbed a piece of paper, and I run over, and I sat back down on the bed, and I thought I'd gotten lucky. I'm opening my hand up real slow because I didn't want to mess this up, and I'm opening up this paper real slow because I didn't want to mess this up, and I open up this piece of paper, man, and it was a number to one of y'all. I don't know about you, but that was the first God shot I received in this process, and I couldn't identify with it. I didn't even know it. I'm sitting there on the bed and the voices started. What you gonna call him for? Ain't no need in calling him. Shoot, they get that thing. That thing worked for them. That thing ain't never worked for you. See, it was a gentleman that had been coming by to see about me, come take me a meeting. He'd come call me and see if I was okay. His name was Kevin Butts, and he'd call and he'd come get me sometimes. And I'm sitting there looking at this number, and I'm saying, man, I ain't calling that dude, man. I don't want to hear his mouth. Y'all told me it was the gift of desperation. I went up front in my mama's bedroom there, man, and I called this guy, and I asked him, would he come get me? And would he take me to this transitional house that my pastor had down in Canton, Ohio? See, God had already put a bunch of things in place way before I got here. I didn't have a clue of it, you know, but he had everything already in place for me. He had people already in place for me. He had the circumstances and everything already in place for me before I got here. I didn't have a clue. You know, that guy came, he left his wife and his two daughters, and he came to see about me. That's why That's why this is my life. This is my life. I don't run around with a bunch of folks, but I stay busy. I don't talk about what I do. I just do it because that's what they told me up there at St. Thomas Hospital. Don't talk about it. Be about it. Anyway, this brother came and got me, man, and I left out my mama's house that day blaming my mama for everything that had ever happened to me. See, remember I told you, I don't know how to take responsibility for my actions. I point the finger at everybody else and say it's everybody else's fault. You know, it was not having a father. You know, it was the probation officer. It was the police. You know, it was the judge. It was the prosecutor. It was the people at the foster home. It was always somebody else. I left out my mama's house blaming, crying like a little baby, crying, blaming her for everything that happened. I get up in this truck. I tell you how sick I was. I get up in his truck, and when I get in his truck, he starts the truck, and he's getting ready to pull off, and I tell him, wait a minute. I said, hold it. Wait a minute, Kevin, wait a minute. He said, what, fool? I said, I got to go get my dog. He said, if you don't sit down in his truck, he said, ain't nothing wrong with the dog. Say, you the one with the problem. Let's go work on your problem. The dog okay. I want to take my dog to treatment. We went 71 southbound. That brother went up one side of me and down the other, making me swallow some big chunks of truth about Roosevelt and what Roosevelt was going to have to do if he was going to get this design for living that really works. You know, the truth cut deep, man, and it's painful, and it hurts, man. And he was saying some things to me, man. This Kevin know how to say some things. He was saying some things to me. I'm sitting over there crying. I know a couple of times, man, I looked over at him. I wanted to hit him with an overhand right. But I just sat there and I just cried. A couple of times I wanted to tell him, man, look, just pull the truck over and let me out. I don't want to go with you no more. And I didn't. I just kept my mouth shut. And I went down there, man, to East Tus and Belden. My pastor had a transitional house down there. And I started this recovery process. One of the first things they did was we stood in a circle and we was getting ready to pray. And when we get ready to start praying, I told them, wait a minute, before you start praying for me, because I've been in them circles plenty, plenty times. I told them, I want you to know what you're praying for. And I believe I did somewhat of a fifth step right there in front of them, you know. And you got to be real careful, man. We got people that's religious and not in the program and people that's spiritual because, well, I'm sitting there, I'm crying, and I'm talking about everything, committing adultery, all that. You know, and then when I open my eyes up, you look around, they're sitting there like, they got their mouth open. And like, it was a funny sight, you know. I didn't care, though. I wanted to get the garbage out. And I didn't even know it at the time that this was transpiring, that what I was doing was a part of the healing process. Anyway, I stayed down there a couple months. Then I come back and I start going up there to St. Thomas Hospital every morning. For my first 5 years, every morning, St. Thomas Hospital up there on the detox ward on the fifth floor. There was a meeting up there at 6:45 in the morning. You know, and y'all taught me how to treat people. You taught me how to act. You taught me how to talk. See, because I was full of slang, I was very angry. I thought I was some kind of tough guy. I had all these things, man, that was weighing me down. And as I began to come up there, as I began to go to the chapel, as I began to let all this stuff out of me, I began to get lighter and lighter. The load wasn't so heavy. I got a sponsor. You say, get a sponsor. Get somebody you don't like. I never did like John Wayne, but Dale looked like John Wayne, walked like John Wayne, talked like John Wayne. You know, I got up enough courage, do you hear me? Enough courage to go and I asked him. I said, Dale, would you be my sponsor? He said, you willing to do a few things? I said, look, if you tell me to go stand on this roof at this hospital, I'll go stand up there and I'll stay up there until you tell me to come down. I simply do not want to put one in me. And this is where it began. See, because I had a ninth grade education, man, and my reading and comprehension level was low to none. I forget it as soon as I read it, and I deal with that 100 forms of fear. I got the fear of success and the fear of failure. So I'm trying to live right in the middle here, somewhere in the middle on a daily basis still. And he said this, he said, I'm going to start you on the four absolutes, honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. And then he said this, he said, Rosie, just work them to the best of your ability. That was the turning point for me. The best of your ability. And I said to myself, well, I could do that. See, because I thought I had to do it perfectly. I'd come into these rooms and I thought I had to read it perfectly. And I thought I had to sit perfectly. And I thought I had to say something perfectly. And I didn't know, man, that it was just a learning process. You heard it earlier, Lynette and them, and you heard them say it. It's each one, teach one. No big eyes, no little U's. You know, we all just spokes in the wheel. I've seen people with higher stature than myself coming out in the rooms with them wristbands and the pajamas on. I'm not looking down on their hardships, but I was saying to myself, maybe I got a chance. Maybe I could do this too. And we sitting in the same place, man. We doing the same thing. Trying to get better. Trying to heal. From this hopelessly, seemingly hopelessly state of mind and body. Trying to recover. So, I didn't ask him what we was doing. I just followed his lead. Whatever he told me to do, then that's what we did. I told myself two things when I started on this process. I said, I ain't going to put one in me today, and I'm going to say okay instead of yeah, but. And that's what I began to do. Just following the process. Showing up every day for the man that had one day more than me and the man that had one day less than me. Walking side by side, nobody in front, nobody in back, side by side, trudging this road. I come to find out there is no patent on prayer. Because a lot of times when I was feeling all jacked up, I used to say, look, dude, you got to send me somebody. I'm going crazy here. And there'd be a knock at the door. The phone would ring. I can remember one time, man, I was at home acting crazy. Wasn't nobody there. Wasn't nobody there but me. I'm acting a fool. The phone rang, and I pick up the phone. It's Dale. He was like, hey, what's going on with you? I looked around. Like, I said, oh, who's talking to him? You know, it was God moving. They say it's a spiritual program in his nature. God doing what he do. I'm scared to death. I heard him talking about it. I'm scared to death, man. I'm sober a little while. Don't seem like life getting better for me and it's getting better for everybody around me. I get so scared and I don't want to drink. I take a door off the closet and I nail myself up in my bedroom. One of my sponsees had to come and knock the door down. I'm in there in the fetal position, scared to death. Don't know that I don't know that I don't know that I don't know. I didn't know what to do after they come out of that. I said, well, maybe, they said some of us suffer from grave emotional mental disorder. Maybe it was a mental disorder for me this time. I went over there to St. Thomas Hospital to the psych ward. I get up there in the psych ward, and I'm in there for a day and a half, almost 2 days. And after sitting up there in the psych ward, I heard him say, smoke break. Well, I knew I had some squares. I went to got in line for a smoke break. I'm in the line for a smoke break. And when it comes to my turn, the woman say, I'm sorry, Roosevelt, you haven't been authorized to smoke yet. I don't want to shoot. I got cigarettes. I'm going to smoke. You get me one of my cigarettes. The woman said, the nurse said, I'm sorry, you haven't been authorized to smoke yet. I got even louder. Well, you going to do something? And then she said again, she says, I'm sorry, you haven't been authorized. I said, oh, wait a minute, wait a minute. Wait a minute, she getting quieter and I'm getting louder. I'll be doing the Thorazine Shuffle in a minute. I went on back and got in bed. I was, get that cigarette. I come on up out of there and I realized, Roosevelt, you got to work on some more things. So, you know, it daily took me through the steps. See, and people's talking about the steps, and the steps did me well, but the steps didn't really saturate my spirit. What saturated my spirit concerning the steps was when I sat down with another alcoholic and went through that 164 pages and them 12 steps, them four absolutes, and them 12 traditions. That's when it really began to saturate my spirit. Identifying, watching, I'm still thinking I'm all the way jacked up, but I'm watching this guy across me get better. I'm watching his complexion and his skin change. I'm watching his frown turn to a smile. I know it's a spiritual program in its nature. And one thing I understand is that God got me. From the minute in that back room at my mama's house to this very day, I know God got me. I heard Charlie talking about it. He said, divorces, you know, I've been divorced twice. I used to feel some kind of way when I'd hear somebody in the program say, I've been married 35 years, 40 years. I was at 29 years of marriage, I got my first divorce. I want to thank you, Charlie, for saying something, man, because I was carrying that. You know, I'm trying to work with another alcoholic, and I'm thinking where I thought I failed. No, it just didn't work. And then I get married again, and it didn't work either. You know, so I'm thinking that I failed, but I didn't. Because it's all a learning process. It's just more experience that I can pass on of Roosevelt getting in the way. Roosevelt not allowing God to do what God do, because I can't transmit something that I don't have. So I have to continue to ask questions, because y'all said the dumbest question is the one you don't ask. Y'all said don't wear your feelings on your sleeve. Y'all told me I had to be teachable. I had to become open-minded and willing. But most of all, I had to be honest with Roosevelt first. I went to jail. 9 years, 11 months, 3 weeks sober, I went to jail. I threw a flower pot and a lamp against the wall. She called the police. I went to jail. I had to go through, I hadn't dealt with my anger problems. Regardless of what the situation or the circumstances was, I threw a flower pot and a lamp against the wall. I was wrong. I had to look at Roosevelt. Roosevelt McNeil is the problem. It ain't nobody else. I gotta look at me. You know, it's some very beautiful things that has transpired in my life. You know, I have 5 children, 13 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren. A lot of them haven't seen me drink. My children have seen me drink. They've seen that other side. I can remember coming home, you know, and doors slamming. Because everybody done went to their room. They didn't know which one was coming in the door. Which animal for that day was coming in the door. They ran to their rooms and hide. They don't hide from me no more. They call me. They invite me. Like that young lady was saying earlier, I'm being invited to places. I'm being welcomed to come in. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, God. Thank you for sponsorship. Thank you for the 12 steps. Thank you for the four absolutes. Thank you for the 12 traditions. Thank you for the fellowship. Thank you for the meetings. Thank you for the camaraderie. Thank you for the love. Thank you for the compassion. Thank you for the understanding. Thank you for the hard talks. Thank you for that uncut stuff. Sit down and shut up. Sit up front. You don't know nothing. Thank you. Thank you. I love you, Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the people, Alcoholics Anonymous. Y'all my family. Y'all my family. I love you. You know, this design for living that I have today, you know, I used to say I want that peace that surpasses all understanding. I don't have to say it. I can live it today. My spirit is peaceful. Like the young lady, the young lady just said it, man, I don't have a problem with others. I got a problem with Roosevelt. Anytime something going wrong, anytime I go to look at somebody else, you know, they talked about the part you play. I got to go look in the mirror at Roosevelt. Roosevelt McNeil is the problem. And as I continue to work with guys and do, you know, sometimes, man, listen, I need to say this. I'm getting older. My body don't move as much as it used to. And I don't get around as fast as I used to. And my sponsor told me no is a complete sentence. So I had to learn that too, because I run myself ragged. You know, I love y'all, man. And you notice my cup. I got a cup here. And it says, thou shall not snivel. So I ain't gonna complain about nothing. I ain't got nothing to complain about. And my sponsor, I'm gonna leave you with this, man. I just love y'all, and I thank you for all that you've given me. I thank you for all that you've taken away. I want to say this. My sponsor told me this yesterday. Grateful alcoholics don't drink. Through divorce, through jobs, through firing, through layoffs, through misunderstanding with children, you know, through eviction notices, through everything, grateful alcoholics don't drink. I love y'all. My name is Roosevelt McNeil. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm in the No Matter What Club. No matter what, just for the day, I'm not going to put one in me. Why? It's because I refuse to lose my place in line. Thank you.